Thanks, Clayton. I'm here with Jason Wilson, who writes for The Guardian and many other publications, including Alternet, The Atlantic, and The Medium. He's based in Portland and has been studying the far right for a number of years. As Arun Gupta says of his work, if you want to know about the alt-right, militias, and the Christian right, Jason Wilson is one of the best reporters on right-wing extremism in the age of Trump. So welcome to KABU, Jason.
Thanks so much, Laurie. Happy to be here.
You've been writing about the various alt-right protests across the country, from Boston to most recently, because I was following your Twitter reports in Seattle. But let's first talk about what happened in Portland last weekend. And KABU has provided pretty extensive coverage of the few hundred who showed up in Terry Schrunk Plaza, of the alt-right, and the many more thousands of counter-protesters in surrounding blocks. And you wrote a recent piece in The Guardian about how the Department of Homeland Security Police enlisted the help of an alt-right protester from the American Freedom Keepers to arrest an anti-fascist demonstrator. So what are you finding to be the relationship between the police and the alt-right?
So I did kind of ask some questions of the various participants in that arrest of whether there was a kind of concrete link or communication beforehand, and I didn't find anything like that. But it's still striking, I think, that a DHS officer would ask a partisan protester for assistance, you know, in arresting another protester. And you know, as I said in the report, you know, quoting ACLU sources, I mean, you know, there's a question there about structural bias and why police officers feel more comfortable with one side of this ongoing conflict that's kind of national than they do with the other side. And a question about what would happen if someone from the counter-protest had offered to help a DHS officer arrest someone from the alt-right protest. I mean, I can't imagine what would happen then. So there's a broader question there, I think, about the way in which who police feel comfortable with and who they feel comfortable enlisting help from. And that should be a concern, I think.
Now, in the Portland context, did you observe different treatment of the alt-right and anti-fascist protesters?
Well, I mean, on the whole, throughout the day, I wouldn't say that there was anything, you know, too dramatic, although obviously most of the arrests came from the counter-protest. So that's something striking. But I think that particular incident illustrates something in terms of, you know, where the sympathies or it raises questions about where the sympathies of DHS officers lie. And I think it's appropriate that the U.S. attorneys open up an investigation on that, and hopefully we'll get to the bottom of that.
Now, just from observing some of these protests of the alt-right around the country and just most recently in Seattle, what do you find are the larger aims, or what explains this kind of profusion of protest by the alt-right around the country, and what are the linkages?
The rallying cry really is this idea of free speech. You know, all of these rallies will be held in the name of free speech, and they claim that their free speech is threatened by, you know, particularly anti-fascist Antifa groups who they really have adopted as a kind of enemy. The striking thing is that rallying cry has brought together different segments of the far right and even what we might be encouraged to think of as mainstream conservatives. So, you know, in Schrunk Plaza last week, we had people from the Patriot Movement, you know, inland militia type groups standing side by side with, you know, the alt-right proper, which has arisen from internet subcultures and the like. And also open white supremacist groups like Identity Europa, and, you know, and then mainstream Republicans. The Multnomah County chair of the GOP, James Buchel, you know, spoke to the rally and appealed to young people at the rally to get involved with the Republican Party. And to me, that's striking. That's new. That's quite striking group of different interests and different segments of the right coming together and standing around together and having conversations and finding common ground and who knows, maybe finding common cause. And that's something we need to think about, I think.
The fact that these protesters have launched these campaigns in places, you know, what we think of as more liberal, progressive cities like Seattle, Boston, Portland, I mean, what does that mean?
Well, I think there's definitely, you know, one way of explaining that is that they see these places as enemy territory, and you know, if they can have organizational victories in enemy territory, that's quite meaningful to them, and they see that as having struck a blow against a body of opinion that's opposed to them and opposed to the president. And, you know, supporting President Trump is something that's also a major current in these rallies. With that said, I think a city like Portland has long been a kind of target of far-right organizing. I wrote an article the week before last just detailing the way in which Oregon and the Pacific Northwest were set up as kind of exclusive, you know, white territories, and there were laws to keep people of color out. And across the late 20th century and now, you know, we're seeing a repeat of that now, you know, extremist groups, white supremacist groups targeted Portland because they saw it as a place where they would encounter perhaps less resistance than in cities with larger communities of color. You know, and Portlanders have resisted that in the past, and they're resisting it now. But there's no doubt that that's something that plays into the far right's thinking.
I was just wondering if there was any kind of strategy that you had observed among the far right to try to just elicit more media attention, and regardless of where they might be mounting their protests, perhaps in these whiter cities like Portland, they suspect there won't be so much resistance and therefore gaining that much more media attention, or on the other hand, generating some kinds of conflicts and street battles that might also generate the kind of publicity that they're yearning for.
I think, yeah, zooming out beyond Portland and looking at the way that in general they have staged these kind of incursions into the heart of liberal cities, I think that they are attracted to the prospect of conflict. They are attracted to the spectacle of conflict, and they're looking for these moments, I think, where they're able to occupy space, you know, successfully occupy space in cities seen as liberal, and to, you know, get their messages out in the heart of those cities. And, you know, even when they're outnumbered, as they were in Portland last week, I think that a lot of the time, if they can just occupy that space for a period of time, they see that as a kind of victory and as an opportunity to rally their supporters.
And perhaps emboldened by at least tacit support by the police.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that incident that I reported on, where allegedly a DHS officer asked for assistance from someone who was providing private security, who was a member of a newly formed and apparently Portland-based Patriot Movement militia-type group. I mean, you know, I think that those incidents are certainly, you know, if that turns out to be what's happened, those kind of incidents are certainly emboldening for those people and endorse the idea that they can bring their own private security to these events and that will be well received. So I think that we're in territory there that people will find disturbing, I think.
You have written that when you discuss right-wing movements and ideologies, liberals often dismiss what you've said on the basis that we're not in danger of a fascist takeover, the brown shirts have not yet arrived in the White House, that's maybe we could argue with. But how do these movements impact societies more broadly, whether in the U.S., and you followed the right wing in Australia as well, even in France, how does this affect the goals of the left and even the conversations and dialogue that takes place about various issues?
I think perhaps that recent events, you know, from last year onwards may have given some of the people who used to say those kinds of things to me pause, you know, and I think there is ample evidence of, you know, fairly direct connections between far-right movements and certain people on Donald Trump's staff. There is a kind of presence now in the White House that, you know, may not literally be brown shirts, may not literally be fascist totalitarian government, but, you know, that they've opened up a political space where certain ideas, certain policy moves become possible, become thinkable. Mass deportations, building a wall on the southern border. You know, and I think in general that demonstrates, you know, what I and others, you know, who I've been influenced by have argued in the past, that as long as these movements are out there in public making their arguments, as long as they're recruiting people, as long as they're being indulged or even appealed to by mainstream conservatives, it has a tendency to drag the whole conversation right. It has a tendency to make the kind of policies that they support and promote thinkable, to make them a matter of mainstream debate. Yeah, so you don't literally need a fascist takeover in order for far-right ideas to become part of, you know, the currency of everyday politics. And I've seen that in Australia, in particularly with issues like refugee policy over a number of decades.
So that racism becomes more normalized. It's not unusual to find that kind of racist language, racist behavior.
Yeah. I mean, to use the example of Australia, and I think, you know, we can find examples here too, but an idea that the compulsory detention of refugees, you know, in offshore islands and never letting them into the country, that's gone from a far-right position to a consensus position that centre-left and centre-right parties both effectively support. That's the way it happens, you know, because mainstream politicians, you know, look for ideas that are popular, or look for ideas that can attract a certain segment of the electorate, look for ideas that can mobilise people, and, you know, become kind of, over time, become supportive of those ideas. So I've seen that happen in Australia, and I think, you know, we're seeing similar things happening here now as well.
Now, you wrote in December that the upsurge of hate crimes around the country should certainly be monitored and resisted, but you thought then that it seemed like these fascists or alt-right groups had maybe peaked in terms of their political clout, but you were more concerned then about the Christian rights adherents, who include many more tens of millions of people in this country. And so would you say that's still the bigger threat to progressive ideas and values?
Well, first I would probably have to say that I was wrong about, I think, that the far-right activism having peaked. I mean, the striking thing to me is that the gentleman who assisted the DHS officer was part of a newly formed militia group, you know, who only apparently became active online, you know, in May this year. You know, and I think that movement is emboldened and is still trying to do stuff, and that's pretty clear. The Christian right, I felt the need to write about them because I feel like they've been forgotten in this whole discussion. And there are really strong arguments to say that, electorally speaking, they were the most crucial component of Donald Trump's coalition, despite the fact that he's as godless and immoral, in their terms, a candidate as we've seen in this country in recent history. So, you know, I think that the Christian right is still underestimated. I think that they're capable of mobilizing millions of voters and delivering electoral outcomes. And I think that moves that Donald Trump made early in his administration have shown that he believes that he needs to retain the support of that group to deliver political outcomes for them, so, such as his moves to repeal the Johnson Amendments, you know, which prevent nonprofit groups like churches from outright political advocacy. He clearly believes that he owes those people, and, you know, he's going to try and deliver political outcomes for them, and I imagine that they're going to come out and vote for him again in 2020. So, yeah.
Well, Jason Wilson, thanks so much for coming into KBOO today, and I urge listeners to follow Jason Wilson on Twitter and in The Guardian and other places. And also want to point out your weekly Guardian column, Burst Your Bubble, which tries to understand the right-wing conservative media and its stars. It's very helpful for educating all of us on who's who in the conservative right-wing and growing militia and alt-right movements. Thanks again, Jason.
Thank you so much for having me.